This is Steve Maxner. I'm conducting an interview with Mr. Harold Bowen. We are attending the Firebirds and Rattlers helicopter reunion, Assault Helicopter Company, 71st, and the Alpha 501st. Is that right?
That's correct. The unit went over to Vietnam as Alpha of the 501st. That was the way it was originally organized, and after it was in Vietnam, it was redesignated the 71st Assault Helicopter Company.
Very good. And we are in the Omni Hotel in San Antonio, Texas, conducting this interview. Well, sir, why don't we go ahead and start with, if you would provide a brief description of growing up in North Carolina.
Well, I grew up in southeastern North Carolina, the son of a small tobacco farmer in that area. I was the middle child of three children. I have an older brother, 4 years older than I am, and a sister a couple of years younger than I am. My parents, incidentally, are both still living. They still live in the same house that I was born in, and they have now been married for 73 years, still living alone independently there in Whiteville, North Carolina, Columbus County. Went to school in Whiteville and graduated from high school there. And a month after graduating from high school, I entered the Army.
Well, could you describe what you remember about the Second World War? As you mentioned
about the only thing that I remember about the Second World War was the fact that periodically we had air raid warnings when, you know, all the lights got turned out or the shades got pulled. We had window shades rather than blinds in the house, so that the house could be completely darkened so far as any light showing on the outside. And I remember that happening periodically, apparently when there was spotted enemy activity off the coast, which was only about 40 some miles from my home. And apparently they had occasionally German submarines and other ships, I guess, spotted off the coast there. I also vaguely remember the hullabaloo on the radio when President Roosevelt passed away.
Oh yes, sir.
I remember us being out in the field working with the car driven out alongside of the road, and the radio on the car turned up so that we could follow the news on the radio as the train bearing his body back up, I guess, to Washington, made the various stops along the route.
Yes, sir.
But those were about my only memories of that era.
Mm-hmm. But do you remember anything about like the drives and rationing and stuff like that? Rubber drives or tin drives or anything like that?
Not much about the drives. I remember us having the rationing books and Mom and Dad, you know, saying that we couldn't get this or we couldn't get that because we didn't have ration coupons available, and that kind of thing. I remember that we had an older car, and Dad wanted to buy a new car. This was, I guess, primarily shortly after the war, and production was extremely limited on new cars after they had gone back to making cars. Of course, during the war, they were not making new cars. The only thing you could buy was a used car, and they were very expensive if you could find one that was for sale. But after the war, he was in the market for a new car, and I remember that as a general rule, you had a very tough time finding one. You got on the list for a car at a dealer, and hopefully one would become available. And you took it the way the dealer offered it, and as I recall, they like to dab every extra on them that they had available at that time, and mm-hmm. we're talking about things such as mud flaps on the back and maybe a squirrel tail on the radio antenna and things of that nature. Anything they could add on it to increase the price of it a little bit.
Yes, sir.
Of course, you didn't have any of the options that we have for cars today. There's no such thing as the power features or air conditioning or anything of that nature. A fully equipped car, so far as we were concerned, had a radio and heater. That was the only thing you were interested in. The rest of it were things about as valuable as a squirrel tail or mud flaps or things of that nature.
Yes, sir. Well, as you were nearing graduation from high school, what made you decide to join the military?
Well, probably I believe 1954, which was a couple of years before I graduated, mm-hmm. we had a hurricane off the coast of North Carolina, mm-hmm. Hurricane Hazel.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
And it was quite a severe hurricane. And I recall that the Whiteville battery of the North Carolina National Guard was activated to go to the coast to patrol the coast, protect property from looters and things mm-hmm. of that nature. Mm-hmm. And as a high school student, I thought that was a very cool thing to do. You know, mm-hmm. I regretted that I wasn't able to participate in that.
Yes, sir.
So as soon as I turned 17 and was eligible to join the National Guard with parental permission, of course, mm-hmm. I did so that the next time the National Guard was activated, I would be able to go with them.
Yes, sir.
And I had a girlfriend that I was going with in high school, and we jumped off between my junior and senior year in high school when he eloped and got married. Mm-hmm. And so when we lived there with my parents then after we were married, and I went to my senior year in school married, and she went to her junior year married. Mm-hmm. And when I graduated, I really didn't know what I was going to do in southeastern North Carolina at that time. There wasn't much of an opportunity. So I decided I would go on active duty. And I joined the Army, went through basic training at Fort Jackson, South Carolina, and was assigned to an M-38 75 millimeter sky sweeper, AAA anti-aircraft artillery.
Yes, sir.
Course at Fort Bliss, Texas, to okay. become fire control mechanic on the old 75 millimeter sky sweeper.
Okay. You know, I'm sorry, sir, before we continue with your training, I forgot to ask you, what do you remember about the Korean War, and what impact did that have on your community there in Whiteville, North Carolina?
I don't know that the Korean War really had that much of an impact. I remember, of course, much more detail about the Korean War, because I was up 12 years old when that started. but it was a more limited action that really did not involve the American people back home, I think, to the extent that the Second World War did. You know, we were not rationed in any way. We were not deprived of any of the luxuries or necessities of life in order to conduct the war. And so, you know, for those people who did not have family involved personally in the war, life pretty much went on as usual. And I did not have family involved, so I think we could say that my life was really not affected by the Korean War.
Did you have family who served in the Second World War? Uncles or brothers or anything?
I had an uncle that was in the army entered the army right toward the end of the Second World War. He never was deployed overseas.
Okay.
So now. That probably is the closest relative I had. I had some cousins that were involved in the Second World War, but these were not family members that I really knew at that time.
Okay.
So no. I would say not.
Do you recall when before President Eisenhower went into office? Of course, there was a big conflict between President Truman and General MacArthur. And I was wondering if maybe you remembered how that was how folks in your community, perhaps in your family, your father, your mother, if they responded to that at all, or if they were just too busy living day by day, raising a family in rural North Carolina.
Well, I think the general population in that area, I think, considered MacArthur very much an American hero.
Yes, sir.
And there was an awful lot of resentment of Truman for relieving MacArthur the way he did. But I think most of those people probably were not truly aware of the way MacArthur had become. From everything that I have learned from accounts that I have read since I became an adult and became more interested in things of that nature, MacArthur really had overstretched the bounds that any serving military officer can go to, and I think most serious military historians agree that if anything, Truman probably bent over backwards to avoid relieving MacArthur, probably simply because he realized the furor that such a move would cause politically. But it finally became necessary, and he did it.
Yes, sir.
And I think history now reflects that probably was the better move, although I think there still is some question as to whether or not MacArthur was right in what he wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
It frankly was not his decision,
right.
by the Constitution of the country and all. He had his boss, and he was duty bound to follow his orders, and he didn't do it.
That's right. Yes. Well, is there anything else that you remember about the Korean War, and did it impact your decision to join the military at all? You mentioned, of course, the impact of Hurricane Hazel and your decision to join the National Guard. I didn't know if perhaps.
I don't think either the Second World War or the Korean War impacted my decision to join the military. Mm-hmm. I think probably the fact that I was married so early, mm-hmm. and the background that I came from and all, mm-hmm. that probably was the most important thing.
Okay.
I really, a lot of kids, some kids anyway, have a pretty distinct idea when they finish high school what they want to do with their life. Mm-hmm. I really did not.
Okay.
Even after I served a 3-year tour in the Army, mm-hmm. I still did not know what I wanted to do. I really re-enlisted in the Army, mm-hmm. for lack of a better plan.
Okay.
And stumbled into a 26-year career.
Okay.
I always jokingly said that I was going to get out of the Army if I ever decided what I wanted to be when I grew up.
Okay.
And I guess I never did decide.
Very good. Well, let's go ahead and get back to training then. Take a step back before we get into your AAA training. So that was here at Fort Bliss, right, in Texas.
The AAA training was, yes.
What do you remember most about your basic training? Does anything come to mind when you think about basic training in the Army in South Carolina?
Well, probably the thing that probably the thing that failed to impress me the most was, in fact, the fact that with the name Bowen, mm-hmm. B in the alphabet, the second letter, every new place that I went to, I'm at the top of the roster for KP, so I go into the replacement depot that everyone goes to,
yes,
when they go on a military post, mm-hmm. and we get in about 1:30 or 2 o'clock in the morning, mm-hmm. after a bus ride from Raleigh to Fort, mm-hmm. Jackson, South Carolina,
mm-hmm.
and after the usual games with the drill sergeant drawing, mm-hmm. bed linens and that kind of thing, we're sent into a bunk, to a barracks, and given a bunk and taught how to make a bed. And finally, about 3 o'clock or so, we get to lay our head down. And about 3:30, I'm roused for KP.
Oh, goodness.
And so I spend the day in the consolidated mess, mm-hmm. doing KP, and 4 or 5 days later I leave the replacement depot and go over to my assigned basic training company,
mm-hmm.
and guess what? The first day in the company I'm on KP again.
Oh no.
And you know, that was not a fun time.
No, sir.
But that, and the fact that during Zero Week,
mm-hmm.
there was some, and I don't remember the event that triggered this, but there was some alert,
mm-hmm.
for the military forces. This was would have been during the first two or three days of July of 56. And we did a forced march before training started. You know, we loaded up all of our gear and marched so many miles off into the to the training area. And after we were all thoroughly exhausted, they announced that whatever the alert was had been resolved, and we turned around and marched the same distance back. So we were all dragging butt by the time we got we got back. I don't suppose there really was any alert of any kind. I suppose that was a line that we were fed to try to justify in our minds the march, but we never were told the deal there. We just the entire battalion did a forced march out into the boonies and back. I don't know. Very, very tiring, very depressing.
Yes, sir. I can only imagine. Let's take a break for a moment. Okay, so we're back from our very brief break. All right, sir. Why don't you, if there's nothing else about basic training you want to discuss, why don't you go ahead and talk about your advanced training for Bliss for anti-aircraft artillery?
Well, I went out to Fort Bliss in September of 56 and attended the radar repair course that I was assigned to. And was retained there in the school as an instructor after graduation, and I wasn't very content as an instructor. I didn't care for that duty, and finally in February of 58 was able to wangle a reassignment to a unit in Germany as a crew member on the gun system that I had been trained on. And arrived in Germany, Mannheim, Germany, in February of 1958, and remained there until June of 1959, when my enlistment expired. My wife had joined me over there at my expense. I was not of a rank eligible for dependent travel, so I had to pay her way over myself, and we lived on the economy. But we stayed there together for about a year, and then I was coming up on my ETS and would be coming back to the States, and I had decided that I didn't want to re-enlist in that position. In fact, I really didn't have any solid plans to re-enlist at that time. I hadn't decided what I wanted to do. And of course, money was extremely limited. So I, a couple of months before I was going to DeRose back to the States, there was a charter flight that I was able to get my wife on for considerably less than a scheduled flight. So I sent her back early, and then 2 months later I came back to the States, went to Fort Jackson, and while I was there gave some serious thought to what I was going to do. And decided to re-enlist. Meantime, I should have covered this earlier before I went to Germany. In fact, in the end of July, of 57, my oldest daughter was born.
Okay.
And so here I am, you know, with a wife and a child, and no idea what I wanted to do, so I re-enlisted.
Okay.
Of course, the sky sweeper system that I was assigned to was really old technology. That sky sweeper system was initially developed back in the 1930s. But it was because of the contingencies of the war and all, it was not brought online as a weapon system until about 19 probably in the 52-53 time frame at the close of the Korean War, before it was brought online. And of course the Nike Ajax missile was brought online very shortly thereafter and made the gun system obsolete.
Yes, sir.
All right.
So my system had a very short useful life as a deployed gun system, and I began to see that was a dead end field.
Yes, sir.
So, but I re-enlisted and was assigned to West Point as a crewman on a system they had up there. Reported up there in July of 1959.
Mm-hmm.
Moved my family up there, and we lived in Highland Falls, New York, in an apartment that we rented.
Mm-hmm.
We're there for about 4 months, and my wife and I decided that we had just we had just gotten married too young, and it was best to call the whole thing off. So I moved her back to Whiteville, and I was stationed back up at New York. Meantime, in February of 1960, the gun system that we had up there, which we used incidentally to train the cadets on the system, it was an orientation system for them. That was turned in. We got rid of it. So I had no position there and was declared excess, and in April was transferred back to Fort Bliss, Texas for retraining.
Have we had any rain?
I went out there and held a variety of jobs. Met my current wife out there, and had quite an experience. I wound up as a trainee on the.
All right. Well, thank you for calling back.
The 90mm radar system, which was also obsolete. So this was a dead-end career.
Mm-hmm.
And in a formation one day, the first sergeant asked for volunteers to go to language school. Well, I'm looking for anything to do. Of course, I'm single at this point, dating my wife, but my current wife. But we haven't married yet. So I raised my hand and volunteered for this language school, thinking I'm going to go to a year's language course in Monterey, California, which I considered a gravy assignment.
Mm-hmm.
Just wanted to double check and see if
didn't hear anything for quite some time. And then about 3 months later, I'm out in the field with some of the trainees that we had, and a Jeep comes out and picks me up, says I've got to be in Washington, D.C. to go to school on Monday, and this is Thursday. So we do a rushed post-clearing exercise, and on Friday afternoon, I hit the road for Washington, D.C.
Okay.
Drive straight through to my home in Whiteville.
Mm-hmm.
Got in late Sunday afternoon, and spent Sunday night with my parents.
Mm-hmm.
And about noon Monday, I take off for D.C. and get up there and find out that I was supposed to be there Monday morning, not Monday night, but that's okay. And I find out that there are 12 of us there.
Mm-hmm.
To attend one of five different languages. No one knows anything about us. Apparently the action officer out in the Pentagon who had set this whole thing up had since he put the ball in motion, he had been transferred.
Okay.
And we're split between the language of Laos, Lao, Burmese, Indonesian, Malaysian, and Cambodian. Those five languages. There are three of us in the Lao group.
Mm-hmm.
All from Fort Bliss. All 12 of these people, incidentally, come from either Fort Bliss or Fort Hood.
Okay.
There's seven from Fort Bliss and five from Fort Hood. The five from Fort Hood are with the 319th MI Battalion, which was out there at the time.
Excuse me, sir. I'll go ahead and stop.
Yeah.
But anyway. Okay, but okay. So you're in Washington. You're getting ready to,
okay,
go to this language training. But I'm curious, what did anybody explain to you what the purpose of this language training was for? And
No one knew. What we were told after we got up there was, we don't know anything about this project.
Mm-hmm.
Except we know that the contract has been let with the school.
Okay.
It's too late to get out of that.
Right.
So we're going to go ahead and let you go to the school.
Okay.
We were there for 3 months.
Okay.
You know, it was a cram course.
Yes.
And then five of you were from the 319th MI Battalion, Military Intelligence Battalion.
Mm-hmm.
The seven of you that are from Fort Bliss, we're going to transfer you to the 319th.
Okay.
We're going to put all 12 of you there in one organization.
Mm-hmm.
If we ever figure out what it is we're supposed to do with you, we'll know where to find you.
Okay.
And they did that.
Okay.
Well,
yeah.
Turns out that, sure, that now some of the guys apparently were very excuse me. Now.
Yes, sir. Okay, go ahead.
Forgotten where I was now.
Oh, but they had the contract, and you
want
to go through this 3-month cram course on Laotian, of all things.
Yeah.
Now, was Vietnamese one of the options as well? You didn't mention.
No, Vietnamese was not one of the options.
Wow.
But this is in 1961 now.
Right.
So Vietnam is not an active situation.
But, you know, it's interesting, though, because, of course, the focus being on Laotian or Cambodian and other Southeast Asian languages.
It's in that area. It's in that area, definitely.
But
actually, there, I think during that time frame, there was more guerrilla activity going on in Laos and Cambodia than there was in Vietnam. But it was all part of the old what was known as Indochina.
Yes, sir. Well, what did y'all think about the election of President Kennedy?
Well, at that time, I really wasn't. I can't say that I was very informed politically.
Okay.
I think, you know, in my own mind, I was a Nixon supporter. I think that Kennedy was good for the military. He rebuilt a military that had been pretty much decimated during the Eisenhower era. Primarily, I guess, because the emphasis during that time had been on the big boom, and there really won't be much of a war. It'll be boom, boom, and it'll all be over. And I think that is a guaranteed recipe for failure. Kennedy started the rebuild of the military, and
it's part of his flexible response.
Yes, exactly, and certainly that's essential. At any rate, going back to the course, we finished the course very unsuccessfully, I might add, because we had a series of exchange students as instructors in Laos. We had, during the 3-month course, we had 3 different instructors, each one from a different region of Laos. And Laos is the language is very different in the different regions because of dialect.
Yes, sir.
And each one would start us all over again because what you've been learning is all wet. That isn't right. This is the right way. And so,
were these different Hmong tribes as well? The hill tribe people, or was
no, they were just the first one was from Pakse, I recall that.
Okay.
One was from Vientiane. And the third one may have been from the Hill tribe.
Hmm.
But what we found out during the course of the instruction, we were the second, third, and fourth people that the Army had ever tried to train in Laos.
Okay.
Simply because the language of Laos was the language of the peasants. The Army had sent an Army attaché way back in the 50s, they had sent an Army attaché to a Laos course, and found after he got over there that the language was worthless to him, because the educated people that an attaché dealt with used French. Laos was beneath them. The language, by the way, is Lao, not Laotian. That's one thing. You know, everybody wants to say Laotian, but the language is Lao. So the Army had discontinued training their attachés in Lao and sent them to French course instead. So as a result, The Army had no skill digit for the Lao language. They had no test to determine your proficiency in the Lao language. So I couldn't be awarded a linguist MOS when I was reassigned to the language company of the MI battalion. I still, you know, I have an obsolete MOS and I can't get it changed because the Army doesn't have anything to give me in that language. Well, Laos and Thailand are in the same region. Therefore, the languages must be very similar, right? But the hierarchy in the company said that the languages must be very similar. They in fact use different alphabets, so they aren't. And we had a qualified Thai linguist in the unit, and they decided they're going to take us three Lao linguists, and they're going to make us Thai linguist and test us and give us an MOS and all. And we start this program. Well, about 6 weeks into the program, the Thai linguist gets transferred from the 319th MI Battalion Language Company to the 519th, which is at Fort Bragg. So any continuation of that training program is impossible. And that's when I decided, you know, by now I'm an E5. I've been an E5 for 3 years. And I'm looking around in the Army of that era and seeing, you know, I've got 6 years service. I'm an E5. And there are E5s around with 15 years service. Promotions were slow to non-existent. I'm not seeing anyone get promoted. And in the meantime, like I said earlier, in May of 62, my current wife and I were married. And I decided I had to do something with my career besides sit here and enjoy myself doing nothing. I've gotten divorced from the first wife. I'm paying child support and doing all this on an E5 salary. I don't have a very promising future. So I applied for OCS and reported in to Fort Benning to go to infantry OCS in late July of 1962, and went through OCS, graduating in February of 1963. While I was in OCS, they impressed upon us that every good infantry officer, as they put it then, is either airborne, ranger, or an aviator. Now, I knew absolutely nothing about small airplanes. Had never ridden in one. The only airplane I had ever ridden in was a passenger plane, commercial plane. But you know, the idea of jumping out of a perfectly good airplane doesn't impress me. And Rangers had the reputation for eating snakes, and I hate snakes. And I didn't want to eat one. So of the three options, that leaves flying.
Yes, sir.
Besides, flying pays extra money.
Yes, sir.
So I volunteer again. I'll go to flight school.
Now, what did you understand that would mean? Did you think it meant small fixed-wing aircraft or rotary? When you volunteered?
At the time I volunteered. Now, you volunteered for one or the other.
Okay.
At the time I volunteered, the idea of flying a small fixed-wing appealed to me more than the idea of flying a helicopter.
Yes, sir.
So I applied for small fixed-wing.
And that would have been like the O-1, the Bird Dog, or something?
So I flew Bird Dogs and O-6s.
Mm-hmm.
O-6s, U-6s,
mm-hmm.
L-20s.
Okay.
When I was back at Rucker as an instructor between tours,
mm-hmm.
I transitioned into the T-41 and T-42.
Mm-hmm.
Got my twin checkout in the T-42.
Okay.
And then before I went back to Vietnam for my second tour, I transitioned into the Queen Air, and I can't remember the designation of the thing now. The twin turbojet that the Army had at the time.
Did you say it was a King Air?
Queen Air, I think.
Oh,
it was.
Queen Air.
Yeah.
Oh.
It was a utility aircraft that the Army had.
Was it a larger than the Caribou, or was it a large or small one?
It was about a six passenger
mm-hmm.
plane.
Oh, just a passenger plane.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And they had some versions of it with some observation gear on it was used for various sundry missions, but I never flew them. I went to the transition course
to go into a rotary,
and that was it.
Now, you mentioned the L-20 or the O-1, and what else? The U as the smaller aircraft. You mentioned the L-20 and the U something.
Well, the Bird Dog, the O-1, was the primary.
Right.
Fixed-wing aircraft of the day.
Right.
And the L-20 or the L-20 or the U-6.
U-6.
Well, the L-20 and the U-6 are the same.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
The same aircraft.
I hadn't heard that designation before. Okay.
See, the L-19 was redesignated the O-1.
Okay.
They're
All
the
right.
same aircraft.
Gotcha.
And the L-20
was designated the U-6.
Was designated the U-6.
Oh, okay.
In the early 60s, the L was light.
Yes, sir.
The Army came up with a new designation system. The O was observation. The U was utility.
Yes,
sir. And the UH mm-hmm. for utility the Huey helicopter. Was utility helicopter.
Yes, sir.
Just the plain U was fixed wing.
All right. Okay. Well, what year did you after you finished? Okay, so after you finished infantry officer candidate school, commissioned in SICFIP 63, volunteer for flight school. So, did you follow on immediately after after infantry training into flight school at Fort Rucker?
Yes. Okay. Yes, I went to Fort Rucker straight from Benning mm-hmm. in 63. Snowbirded down there for a couple of months and started flight school in May of 63.
How long did flight school last for you?
We started the 1st of May
mm-hmm.
and I graduated in February of 64.
Okay.
Was assigned to Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Went to Finthen, Germany, right outside of Mainz, and was assigned to the 1st Brigade of the 8th Infantry Division
mm-hmm.
In their Brigade Aviation Section,
okay.
which had a couple of Bird Dogs and an OH-13.
Mm-hmm.
a couple of 08-13s, I guess. And at one time, we had three bird. We had varying numbers of bird dogs, depending on what was going on. Mm-hmm. There were, at various times, anywhere from two to about five pilots assigned to the section.
Okay.
And we were there until February of 67. But in the meantime, in 65, of course, Vietnam was warming up considerably.
Yes, sir.
And the Army started a program in Germany. They collected some Huey aircraft and started a course down at Stuttgart to qualify all of the rotary wing pilots in Hueys.
Okay.
They finished that, got all those guys qualified, shipped most of them out to Vietnam, and then they collected some OH-13s and started a program to transition all of the fixed wing pilots into helicopters. And I was in the third class, I think, that they did. Went down, this was started up at Oberschleißheim, right out of Munich. There was a big airfield down there that they started this program at. We had about 8 or 9 weeks. Got, as I recall, 50 hours of H-13 time and 10 hours of Huey time. And then I went back to my unit, graduated in July of 66, went back to my unit, and by that time, you know, people were leaving for Vietnam right and left.
Yes.
Meantime, I had in late 65, early 66, I guess it was. Early 66. In fact, the week before the Army and the Air Force made the deal to give the Caribou to the Air Force, I had put in a request for a Caribou transition and reassignment to Vietnam, because Caribou was the hot aircraft. And I knew I'm going to Vietnam. Everybody's going to Vietnam, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's a matter of what can you get out of it before you go. So I wanted to fly the Caribou. By that time, the Caribou is now the Buffalo, which had turbine engines. Mm-hmm. That was basically the difference in them. And I wanted to fly that. So I put in a request to go to Vietnam with the Caribou transition en route. And sometime later, a week after I put the request in, the Stars and Stripes has this article about this deal that's been made, see?
Uh-huh.
So I says, oh hell.
Yeah.
And but the Army had the gall to come back. And I remember the endorsement back on my paperwork very clearly. It said that my request had been approved.
Okay.
I was going to go to Vietnam.
Not the Caribou training.
It didn't mention a Caribou transition. Yeah. It told what unit I was going to be assigned to and everything.
What month and year was this, do you recall?
This was in early 66.
Okay.
It was before I went to the helicopter
excuse me
course.
Okay.
But
just had an idea.
I'm not going to Vietnam for a year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I got orders a year in advance going to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Meantime, you know, I go back and I tell, hey, you made a mistake. I mean, you know, that's not what I asked for. You say my request is approved, but you didn't give me what I asked for.
Uh-huh.
Well, we gave you the essential agreement, the essential ingredient of what you asked for. You asked to go to Vietnam. We gave you that.
Right.
You know, I mean, all the conditions you attach to it, they don't count.
No.
Okay. Well, I mean, I can see the handwriting on the wall. Well, that's a losing argument. You know, you don't bother to wager it.
No.
So, I check into this unit, and I find out that the unit that they say I'm assigned to is a bird dog unit.
Mm-hmm.
That is being formed at Fort Campbell, Kentucky.
Okay.
For shipment to Vietnam.
Okay.
Then, in the spring, I come out on orders for the helicopter course.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Mullins.
So I call BA.
I can always call him. Just
I don't want to fly helicopters.
He acted like he didn't even know some of the people.
So the assignments officer at DA says, that's fine, you don't have to go. Yeah, because I'm going to incur this new military obligation if I go.
Sure.
I don't want that. I'm not, still not sure that I want to stay in the Army, see. I'm thinking very seriously about getting out and trying to fly commercially or something like that.
Okay.
So he says, well, you don't have to go if you don't want to.
Well, I'd love to.
But
well, I'd love to do that with you.
If you don't go,
the deal closes.
You're gonna pull a tour in Vietnam, and then you might as well get out of the Army because you're finished. If you can't do what we want you to do, we don't have a place for you.
Wow. That's pretty blunt.
Well, and I'm not one that likes to burn my bridges.
Sure.
So, okay, well, what the hell? I'll go fly helicopters. I mean, I'm already on orders for Vietnam for fixed wing, so I'm not going to have to fly helicopters over there, right? I go down to Munich, and I go through the training program. It was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed flying helicopters, but I didn't want to fly them in Vietnam.
Now, what were you trained on? Were you trained on the Huey? Did they throw you right
in the gun? I got a 50-hour transition into the OH-13.
Okay.
And then 10 hours in the Huey.
Okay.
Just enough to learn how to crank the thing.
Orientation.
Yeah.
Okay.
Graduated in early July of 66.
Mm-hmm.
Went back to my unit, and very shortly after I got back there, of all the pilots we had in the unit, I wind up as the only one left. So I'm flying the brigade commander around.
Mm-hmm.
in the H-13, so I get quite a bit of H-13 time.
Mm-hmm.
Over the next several months. Keep in mind that I'm on orders to Vietnam already.
Right.
To go over in meantime, my assignment to the unit at Fort Campbell.
Mm-hmm.
Was changed, and I get orders to go direct to a unit, a bird dog unit in Vietnam. But the time frame is the same. I'm going over in February of 67, March of 67.
Okay.
So all my classmates.
Mm-hmm.
from the transition course.
Mm-hmm.
Who don't have orders to Vietnam already.
Right.
They receive orders and leave.
Okay.
Because of their new qualification.
Okay.
But I've already got orders. So I don't get new orders. I just,
sure.
So I wound up staying over there longer than anybody else.
Okay.
Everybody else leaves, I'm still there.
Okay.
But finally, I de-roast back then in in February of 67.
Mm-hmm.
Never flying a Huey from July until I left Germany in next February.
Mm-hmm.
Never touched a Huey. Report to go to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Wind up there at Long Bend in the replacement detachment.
Mm-hmm.
And find out that the orders that you travel to Vietnam on become null and void when you arrive at Long Bend. You're in the pot with everybody else.
Right.
He was asking us
and
if we should.
They're not looking for bird dog pilots, they're looking for Huey pilots. So I get orders to the 145th Battalion.
Okay.
They're at Long Bend. Actually at Benoit,
mm-hmm.
but it's right near Long Bend.
Mm-hmm.
And go down to the 145th,
mm-hmm.
and am assigned to the 71st. The 71st at that time is at Benoit.
Okay.
And I don't remember the date. We could check it. I actually wind up assigned to the 71st the same day that Major Eric assumes command from Major Morris.
Okay. This is what, late 66 or early 67?
No, this is March now of 67.
March of 67. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, before we talk about your first tour in Vietnam, let me ask you a couple of quick backup questions regarding events that happened in the early 60s. In particular, of course, in November of 1963, of course, there's quite a bit of interesting, a lot of interest going on both in Vietnam and in the U.S. with the assassination of the Vietnamese president, Ngo Dinh Diem. And I was wondering if that made its way to you guys while you were still in, were you in Germany at that point, in November 63, or were you still back in the States?
November of 63, I started flight school in May,
That's right, you're in the middle of flight school.
Yeah. But November of 63 is actually when Kennedy was assassinated.
Right, two weeks later.
Yeah.
2 weeks after Diem's killed in Vietnam, President Kennedy's killed here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering if you guys even paid attention to what was going on in Vietnam in 63. If you even remember what was coming back to the U.S. in terms of news from that country.
I remember his assassination, and I remember his wife's mm-hmm. comments about that when Kennedy was assassinated, you know, which was something to the effect that, you know, he deserved it because, I mean, you know, I think she pretty openly accused him of being involved in her husband's assassination.
Yeah.
And
did the Kennedy assassination impact you guys? And what do you remember most about that?
I don't know that it impacted us training wise any more than it did. Other people in the country. I mean, you know, I of course remember being very affected by it emotionally and all.
Yes, sir.
It was quite a traumatic experience for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't recall anticipating that it would have any real effect on the Army per se any more than it did all the rest of the country.
Sure.
I didn't foresee that the direction the Army was going to go in was going to change or anything like that.
Okay.
Certainly at that point, though I snowbirded for 2 months with a combat developments organization at Fort Rucker mm-hmm. before my flight school class started. And they were very actively involved in at least keeping up with what was going on in Vietnam and what was going to be needed there and that kind of thing. And though their ability to foresee at that point, you know, this is early to mid 63, you know, no one certainly foresaw that it was going to become anything like it did.
Right.
Still, I think they probably had better insight into it than most people did. And so you know, I was aware of the Southeast Asian situation, but not really concerned about it because it's doesn't affect us now.
Sure.
I mean, what the hell, you know?
Yeah, by 63, it's still not.
No.
It's not a major possibility
no.
for you guys to be sent over.
No.
Did you know any advisors who had served over there and come back? Did you meet any?
Yeah, we had a couple there in the combat developments mm-hmm. Organization that had. Don't recall if they had been to Vietnam. They had been to Southeast Asia.
Okay.
We had advisors. In fact, at one time there, we probably had more in Laos and in Cambodia mm-hmm. than we actually did in Vietnam.
Do you remember anything they might have talked about with regard to their service over there that early?
Not specifically. No, no, I don't.
Okay. Well, what do you remember about when the Gulf of Tonkin incidents occurred in 64, August of 64? Do you remember anything about that?
Not a great deal. I recall, you know, that we in the military took everything at face value and you know, the line that was put out by the powers at the time portrayed it that there was absolutely no provocation on our part. You know, it was a brazen attack against us, and you know, I think for the most part those of us at the line level accepted that hook, line, and sinker. I had never, you know, in those days it never occurred to any of us that anyone was being less than truthful and candid.
Yes, sir.
With us.
Yes, sir.
At the level I was at the time.
Sure.
So, hell yeah, there's some of the guns want to start something like that, we'll fix their ass. Excuse me. But, I mean, we can easily handle this. This is not something that we need to get mm-hmm. concerned about.
Okay. Well, prior to leaving Germany and going to Vietnam, what kind of indoctrination training, you know, and just informational training did you receive about Vietnam itself and what service would be like there in that country? Did you receive any kind of orientation before leaving Germany that you remember?
No, not before leaving Germany.
How about when you got to the replacement unit there at Benoit? Do you recall any kind of orientation when you arrived?
I haven't met anybody, but that's why I knew it because I'm.
And then how about when you got to the 71st?
It does take time. There's so many
differences. Was there anything more than just a unit orientation, cultural orientation? What's going on here in Vietnam orientation?
No, there's no kind of orientation.
Interesting.
I mean, you're here. Look around you. Open your eyes.
Open your eyes. That's your orientation.
Okay. No. I mean, a flight orientation. You're here.
Sure.
You're here to fly. That's
sure.
what you do.
Right.
I remember. You know, I took my orientation check ride with Rance Kirby,
mm-hmm.
who was one of our KIAs,
mm-hmm.
and I think I was, he was next to last orientation check ride.
Mm-hmm.
He gave one either the next day or a couple of days later, and that was the flight that he was killed on. Of course, I remember that.
Sure.
Affecting me. Rance was a very able and accomplished pilot.
Mm-hmm.
He took me, you keep in mind now that I got 10 hours in the Huey.
Right.
And then I went about 9 months without touching one.
Mm-hmm.
So I barely remembered how to start it when I took my orientation ride with Rance.
Right.
And Rance gave me quite a ride. And
what model Hueys were you guys flying at that point? What model was your car?
I think those were all Delta models. I think we had Delta models at that time. We had the training that I had received at Munich,
mm-hmm.
was in a B model,
mm-hmm.
Because all the Delta models had been pulled out to go to Vietnam.
Sure, they wanted the extra power there.
Yeah, but We had Delta models in the 71st.
Mm-hmm. Did you notice a big difference between the B models that you flew in Germany and the Delta model you were flying in Vietnam?
Well,
could you feel the difference, or did you remember?
It had been too long since I had flown the B model.
Okay.
Everything was different. Rance flew me much more than a normal check ride.
Okay.
And at the conclusion of the ride, he said, you know, I'm gonna go ahead and sign you off so you can start flying. But he said, you're extremely rusty.
Mm-hmm.
We've got some good aircraft commanders here, very competent guys. You listen to them, they'll take care of you.
Very good.
And that's what I try to do. You know, and keep in mind, I'm coming into the unit. I'm a captain. I've got 11 years service now.
Mm-hmm.
Most of these guys, you know, in fact, I don't recall us having a single W-2 in the unit. These guys are all W-1s.
And they're aircraft commanders.
Oh yeah. Well, our aircraft commander, Peter Bilot system over there, had absolutely nothing to do with rank. It's strictly to do with proficiency in the aircraft and the length of time that,
yes, sir.
That you've been there.
Yes, sir.
And I came in and I flew as Peter Pilot with those guys, and I think I made it very clear to them from day one that when we get in the aircraft, when it has to do with the operation of the aircraft, you're the boss. and they took good care of me, and I think by the time they the system that we had, the other aircraft commanders in your platoon had to agree on each guy as he came along. They had to agree that he was ready to become an aircraft commander before he would be signed off.
Sure.
And you know, even after, see, I became with the changing in the situation and all, I became the platoon leader while I was still a Peter pilot.
Okay.
And I told him that nothing has changed.
Right.
I'm the platoon leader, but I'm still a Peter pilot until you guys say that I'm ready.
On the ground, administratively, and all the rest.
That's right.
You're the platoon leader.
When we get
in that aircraft,
it's yours.
Yeah.
And they trained me, and they kept me going.
That's great.
And you know, that's.
And in particular, I was wondering if you could describe how you felt your training and before going to Vietnam. How well did that prepare you for your service in Vietnam? And in particular, of course, in terms of leadership, but also some of the nuts and bolts of just being in the Army now and finding yourself in a war. Did you feel like you were well prepared for what you encountered?
No, I don't think that I was prepared at all. I think I had probably more insight as an officer, leadership wise, than a lot of the guys, simply because of my age and experience at the time I arrived there. You know, I had almost 7 years of service before I was commissioned. And so I think I understood the relationship between officers and enlisted much better than many of the officers did, simply because I had been on both sides of the fence, and I think I understood better what a good working relationship could be, and particularly in an aviation unit. I think the working relationship between the pilots and the other crew members, it's a much closer relationship than in a normal in other military units, and I think the warmness of that relationship, the closeness of that relationship, is far more important than it is in infantry units or artillery units or things of that nature. But I think for the most part, our officers understood that. We had a couple of commanders that didn't.
Yeah.
But guys like George Jackson and Dennis Hinn and those guys certainly did understand the relationship much better.
What about what was happening in Vietnam more specifically, and whether or not you felt that you were briefed well enough, or you understood exactly what it was that we were trying to accomplish in South Vietnam?
I think we were probably briefed as well as anyone could brief us at the time. I think Vietnam is a classic example of how this nation should not attempt to wage a war. You know, I'm a firm believer that the politicians do their thing, do their best to resolve issues without involving the military, but that once they involve the military and commit the military in the fray, mm-hmm. they should get the hell out of the way and let the military do their job. That of course did not happen in Vietnam. The restraints that were placed on the military were absolutely impossible to conduct mm-hmm. Proper actions in. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're receiving fire and you're unable to return that fire because you can't specifically pinpoint the exact location that it's coming from, that to me is an unacceptable restraint to place on your people, and we live with that, you know, every day.
Well, you were prohibited from returning fire, even if you were taking fire.
In some areas and at some times during the war, not all the time. Most of the time during my tenure with the 71st, mm-hmm. we did return fire when we received fire.
Okay.
But during my second tour, especially. Most of the time there, you were required to identify the specific target on the ground that was shooting at you.
Okay.
And you can't, you know, from 1,500 feet.
Okay, we will.
Or from any altitude of flying a helicopter, you can't always do that.
Right.
But there is value in, you know, it's coming out of that clump of trees.
Sure.
Or it's coming out of that hooch, so you suppress it.
Sure.
And if you can't do that, then you're sitting up there,
right.
Fat, dumb, and happy.
Right.
Or you know, you've gotten fire out of that hooch for the last 3 days in a row. Mm-hmm. So if you're smart, if you got to fly by there today, you suppress that sucker before you start receiving fire. You can't do it. You're not receiving fire now. It's very easy at night if you're receiving fire with the tracers and all. It's very easy to tell where it's coming from.
That's right.
But not nearly as easy in the daytime. Not nearly as easy. You know, maybe you would know exactly where that fire was coming from if you happen to be looking there when it was fired.
Yeah.
Maybe you wouldn't. You know, it depends on what's down there. You know, a rifle shot during the daytime, mm-hmm. you don't see very much.
No.
You don't see very much. Most of the time, you're just guessing where it's coming from, so far as an exact spot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it depends on the terrain, what's there. But if you're looking down at the little village, Which house did that round come from?
Right.
You don't have any idea.
No.
But you know it came out of that village.
Sure.
And
now, when that kind of stuff happened, would you call in back to the headquarters, and would an infantry unit be dispatched to go down there and ferret that sniper or that group of people out?
Well, no, usually not, because I mean that was an everyday occurrence.
Okay.
So
this was typically
not necessarily in the same location, but various places.
Sure.
This happened all the time. You couldn't.
And this is en route to other missions. You had to keep on going with your other missions. You couldn't stop and investigate.
Oh, yeah.
It's time to shot at.
No.
Well, what did you think about the overall mission of the United States in Vietnam? And in not retrospectively, but at the time, did you have any thoughts one way or the other of what the United States was doing there in Vietnam and whether or not we should have even been involved?
Well, of course, I felt that we should. Mm-hmm. I very strongly felt that what we were doing there was the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
The people that we were exposed to in South Vietnam were of course pro-American. But those were the people that were interacting with the American military there, mm-hmm. and of course if they were not in their inner hearts pro-American, mm-hmm. they certainly were not going to let that be known.
Right.
So that was all we were exposed to. But I think most of the people in South Vietnam probably would have preferred to maintain a non-communist system.
Mm-hmm.
They certainly did not like the ills that were imposed upon them by the Viet Cong and all,
mm-hmm.
but basically what they wanted was just be left alone.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they don't want to be either one.
Yeah.
Leave me alone and let me tend my rice paddy and do mm-hmm. things the way my family has been doing it for the last thousands of years,
mm-hmm.
you know. I don't care about politics. I don't care about any of this. Just leave me alone. This is my little piece of land.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, I don't know anything about the domino theory and all the thing that, you know, that's why we were involved there, because you got to stop the spread of communism somewhere. You know, that's for the politicians to answer. I think what we did over there was wrong, in that you can bet that most of those people that actively supported us over there and were with us over there suffered greatly after we abandoned them.
Oh yeah.
And that was wrong. We should be careful of involving ourselves in situations that we're not willing to see through to a conclusive end. And for that reason, and that reason only, I was terribly opposed to the current involvement in Iraq.
Yeah.
Has absolutely nothing to do with whether or not Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction or whether or not he deserved to be removed from power. I don't think there's any question but what he did. And the way I define weapons of mass destruction, he certainly had them because he had already used them, and that being the gas. And gas is as much a weapon of mass destruction as anything else. Whether or not he was close to developing a nuclear weapon and was able to get rid of the evidence, I don't know. Don't really care. But I was opposed to involving it because I told my wife, the military is going to wind up taking the brunt of the effort there, just like they did in Vietnam. The American, it's going to take a long time in a no-win situation, and the American people are going to tire of the effort and not be willing to pay the price and demand that we get out. And I ask you, what's going on? And the one thing that I did not want to see is just what I'm afraid we're going to see.
Operational stuff in Vietnam. And now I was wondering if you would discuss or describe, I guess, some of your operations in Vietnam as a part of the 71st Assault Helicopter Company. And, you know, what was your area of operations, your primary area, and what kind of support and activities were you engaged in?
Well, about a month after I joined the unit, actually about 2 weeks after I joined the unit was stood down was the term they used. We were put on hold to relocate on what we were told would be a temporary reassignment to support the 196th Light Infantry Brigade. In fact, the 196th Light Infantry Brigade had been selected to be part of Task Force Oregon up at Chulai, which was well up the South China Sea coast, about 40 or 50 miles south of Da Nang. So we were stood down and told to prepare for the relocation. And the stand down actually took about 2 weeks, during which we sat around and waited, you know, the old hurry up and wait game. And finally the day came, and we moved out with the entire company, everything that we could muster, to Chulai. We relocated up there and learned right away that we were in a very different operational environment. We went from very nice, comfortable living facilities at Benoit to tents and sand at Chulai. I think we had been at Chulai for about 30 days when the last of the helicopter engines that we had left Benoit with, the last of the engines was replaced with new engines, and we started replacing engines that had been replaced since we arrived at Chulai. An engine was lasting less than 100 hours of flight time, and we were having engine failures. And this was caused by the sand that we were operating in up there. Every time that we would land the helicopter, you would kick up such a dust storm, and that sand being ingested through the turbine engine, and it was wearing out the turbine blades. sandblasting the blades and causing them to wear out.
Mm-hmm.
And they sent Lycoming tech reps up to survey our operational area and try to determine what we were doing wrong that was wearing out so many engines.
Mm-hmm.
And they came up and took one look at the environment we were operating in, and
mm-hmm.
there's your explanation.
Sure.
So we started receiving shipments of oil and tar and all that they spread on the ground in our flight line area to hold the dust down to keep us from creating dust storms
mm-hmm.
when we landed there, so that a small number of dust storm landings was eliminated. But still, out in the operational area, every landing is in a dust storm. So we improved the situation, but we did not eliminate it. They eventually, that resulted in modified filters for the Huey, which kept out a great deal of the sand. And eventually, that problem was at least greatly reduced. Engine failures were still a very common part of life over there, but at least we can get several hundred hours out of an engine before it failed. But you know, typically we would have usually a company size combat assault, several in the course of a week. We were primarily supporting the 196th Light Infantry Brigade,
mm-hmm.
which had three infantry battalions,
mm-hmm.
and there would be company or larger size operations three or four a week that we would conduct a combat assault. And then the remainder of the missions during the course of the week would be what we referred to as ash and trash missions, resupply. You know, everything that the infantry received out in the field, they received by air, and we took it to them or they didn't get it. Once they left their base camp and went out on an operation, they were totally dependent upon helicopter support. There were no ground vehicles operating out to these outlying sites, simply because road transportation was not safe where there were roads, and in most areas there were not roads to the site. But even if a road existed there, it wasn't safe to travel that route.
Mm-hmm.
Not that the helicopter travel was all that safe, but it was safer than road travel.
Yes, sir.
A typical day might start 4:30 in the morning. Usually, you were taking off on a flight after getting dressed and having breakfast and all. You were taking off on a flight pretty close to first light. Sometimes in the dark, especially in the wintertime, in the dark, you'd go out to the unit that you were supporting for the day, and then fly missions as directed by their S3 Air normally, their operations officer, whose assistant operations officer, whose function it was to coordinate aerial support for the day.
I don't have very many seats left.
These were normally single ship operations and might involve supporting a number of different locations during the course of the day. Quite often you'd be assigned to a battalion for the day, and they would have a number of different elements out at different locations in the field, and you'd be taking supplies to each of those different elements. Supplies involved just about everything that a person needs to subsist. Their food, their water, their ammunition, replacement personnel, whatever they needed, you know, we carried to them. Combat assaults during the time with the Rattlers, most of the combat assaults were company sized operations, which usually involved a complement of 10 aircraft, 10 troop carriers.
How many gunships?
Depending on the situation, either a light or a heavy fire team, light fire team being a two-ship team,
okay.
Heavy being three,
okay.
Three ships. But depending on the tactical situation, it could involve more than that. We really did not like to do combat assaults without some escort. Yeah, we did it on occasion, but that was not something we looked forward to. Combat assaults. Well, during the early days up at Chulai, almost all of our combat assaults were. Of course, what we term full suppression combat assault. You're going into an LZ. Usually these LZs were out in an area where there were no known friendlies. And we like to go in what we term full suppression. And a true full suppression usually involved artillery prep, followed by an Air Force prep, and then we came in with the slicks, with the guns escorting us, and the guns were firing full prep as we went in, and we're firing with the door guns at the same time. And though that is a loud, chattering, nerve-wracking experience, the first time or two you do it, it becomes very reassuring and soothing after a while. You feel much more comfortable going in that way. Sometimes you receive fire, but most of the time when you go in full suppression, you do not receive fire, because what the suppression does is it, if Charlie is there, it forces him to put his head in the hole. And he doesn't do a lot of shooting while he's in the foxhole. You put his head down and And you're okay. You can get in and out quick in a hurry, and that's not going to take a very long time. Most of our troops were well trained in that they exited the aircraft very fast, and those that were not fast enough got a little help, because our crew didn't want to be on the ground there any more than the pilots did. And so if you're a grunt on the board of the aircraft, it behooves you to move real fast or you're going to get some help. We've got a $1 million machine that government doesn't want us wasting. And we certainly don't want to waste it, because if we do, we're going to be stuck on the ground there. And that's not where we want to be. So,
Brenda,
I don't think. I'm sure it happened, and it probably happened more down at Benoit on some of the operations they had down there before I was really involved with the company. I don't know of a single incident in which we had up at Chulai, we had anyone shot on a full suppression combat assault.
Okay.
They were nerve-wracking, but they were reasonably safe.
Okay.
What you got to watch out for is incidents like the one I told about earlier when I took the round through the chicken plate.
Yes, sir.
That was, you know, there wasn't supposed to be any action there that day. The unit was being pulled out. This was in the PZ now.
Okay.
We had put them in that morning, and they were being pulled out because they hadn't found anything in the area.
Right.
And yet, right there in the PZ where they were, in a spider hole, was Charlie. My gunner saw him and killed him.
Well, that brings up an important question. How effective and how accurate did you guys think the intelligence briefings were before you went on operations? Did you feel like you were getting good intelligence or good information prior to your operations, or were you surprised more often than not by those types of events where there wasn't supposed to be anybody there, but all of a sudden, when you get on site, there is? Which was the norm?
I would say just as often as not, the information was
so about 50-50.
Wrong. Yeah,
okay.
About 50-50. You know, this wasn't intelligence information that we had about the area. This was confirmed by the troops on the ground.
Right.
We've been out here all day looking. There's nothing here.
Right. Especially that incident on the PZ.
How much looking they had been doing, I'm not too sure of.
Sure.
And going back to the intelligence, now I'm sure in Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
Have you interviewed Frank Anton and the POWs?
I've interviewed Sam Feaster, Jim Feaster.
Jim Feaster.
But I have not interviewed Mr. Anton yet.
Okay, I was the operations officer when Frank was shot down. And I had, that was the 5th of January. I had 2 months left to go in country.
Right.
And just about that entire 2 months was spent conducting small raids and combat assaults with small, usually five ship formations with a platoon or something like that, reacting to intelligence reports of where Americans, presumed to be POWs, had been spotted. I mean, we were all over the countryside. Every day, almost, we got a report and would scramble and put together five ships to go out and put this unit in because of a sighting here or a sighting there.
Sure.
And on all of them, the intelligence reports we got back was they had been here, but they were moved before we got there. That's what we were told. You talked to Frank. Didn't happen. Didn't happen. He was in a POW camp within a couple of days of his capture. And he was only in four POW camps the whole time he was held in the South.
Wow.
3 years. He was in four camps. He wasn't moving around.
So what would you attribute to this rather frenetic activity, trying to find them and getting this intelligence that said they were there and then getting the feedback on the ground that they were here but were sent someplace else, and this happening? How many times would you estimate that happened? If you were to put just a round figure, was it a dozen, two dozen, more than that?
Over that 60-day period, I would say two dozen times.
Wow.
And keep in mind now, this is the intelligence that we down at the company level are being fed. It's also the intelligence that the infantry unit that we're taking in is being fed.
Well, that's really, it's kind of interesting.
But where is it coming from?
Right.
Where was it generated?
Right.
Was it?
I can take the next person.
Something created within our system, or was it information that our system was being fed?
No, but I can imagine it.
I don't know. But I know that it doesn't match with Anton's experience.
Right.
And our POWs were readily identifiable.
Sure.
Because you know there were two white guys and a black guy.
And that's the information you guys were getting.
Yeah. Yeah.
These are the descriptions of the guys that are supposedly on the ground here.
Yeah.
You know, what a remarkable
bit of information. And I distinctly remember, you know, that information and because the whole company, of course, was very,
of course,
frantic.
Yeah, you guys are trying to find them. Go ahead and pause for a minute. I'm curious. I'm going to go ahead and turn this on again.
Yeah.
The tempo of operations from one area to the other. When you guys moved from Benoit down to up to Chulai, was there a significant increase in the overall tempo of your missions, or was it pretty much the same?
Well,
find yourselves on more operations.
You really would need to to discuss that with someone else in an interview that had more time at July. I really only flew a couple of three missions at July.
Benoit. Okay.
I don't know enough about the tempo down
sure.
there. I recall only going on one combat assault in the Benoit area, and I flew two or three other days
mm-hmm.
on ash and trash missions,
okay.
and that's all I flew there.
But how many months were you there?
At Benoit? Before we stood down, I was there less than 2 weeks.
Oh, okay. 2 weeks, stood down, and then moved to July.
We sat there for 10 days or so after we stood down, during which time we didn't take any missions.
Right.
Just packing up and getting ready to go.
Sure. So by April, May of 67, you're in July.
Oh, in April, we were in July, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
you were
I had
there,
less than 30 days in country when we arrived in July.
Okay. So you were when you were in July then for the rest of your time.
Yes.
With the unit.
Yes.
That means you were there in July during Tet 68, and of course this is the same time frame when Frank was and Jim were captured, January of 68.
Yeah.
And so what? Let me go ahead and pause for a sec. Thank you, sir.
All right.
So. We're back again. Again, we're talking about Tet of 68 now. And so I was wondering if you could tell me what happened there with your unit when Tet hit, and what do you remember about it? And I guess how was your unit prepared for that, if they were prepared at all?
Well, we were not prepared at all. We had grown very. I would have to say lackadaisical,
mm-hmm.
insofar as our perimeter security and all
mm-hmm.
In our company area. We hadn't done much in the way of bunkers and protective areas.
Mm-hmm.
The mortars that the VC had were not, we were well within the perimeter of Chulai. We did not have a perimeter sector responsibility. We were internal in Chulai. Well, inside the compound, and the mortars would not reach us.
Okay.
So we had no fear of mortars impacting in the company area, and we hadn't built bunkers and all as we should have
mm-hmm.
to prepare for that.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, Charlie was not using any of the longer range rockets on Chulai. Of course, that all changed with Tet. They were able to lob some longer range rockets, which did impact in the area,
mm-hmm.
and also they were able to breach the perimeter and get sappers into the ammo dump, which was, as the crow flies, probably less than a half a mile from our company area.
Mm-hmm.
And they were able to destroy sizable munition stashes in the ammo dump. When Tet broke, we actually had shrapnel. I don't think that we actually had any rounds impacting in the company area, but we had shrapnel
okay.
from rounds that did come into the company area.
Mm-hmm.
We had considerable concussion damage. The wall of my hooch was blown out. Mm-hmm. What we had was a screen wire wall to the hooch. Mm-hmm. But this was during the rainy season, and during the rainy season we rolled plastic down to cover that screen wire and keep the rain mm-hmm. out of the hooches. Mm-hmm. And that created a little bit of a barrier to the force of the air from the concussion, mm-hmm. which meant that the impact of the concussion went against the walls.
Sure.
And took the walls out.
Wow.
Since the air couldn't go through.
Right.
So there was damage to the walls because of that.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, immediately after the initial night of Tet,
mm-hmm.
we got very busy building bunkers.
Yes, sir.
So 6 weeks later, when I departed,
mm-hmm.
We had some very
good bunkers,
and I'm sure that they kept bunkers from then on.
Yes, sir.
But the only time that we actually had an impact within the company area that I recall was the night of that Tet first, the night of Tet, when the first incident. After that, even though we Chulai would receive
mm-hmm.
incoming rounds,
mm-hmm.
And we would go to the bunkers anytime that happened, we never had anything impacting in the company area. But we did have shrapnel in the company area that night, and we had damage to some of the buildings. One of the more interesting aspects of this, we had all kinds of indigenous personnel working in the company area.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the other guys may have told you this story, I don't know. We had hooch maids and KP personnel and girls working in the club, and we had a company barber
mm-hmm.
who gave us all our haircuts and shave and he works on you with a straight razor and all that good stuff. And he was one of the bodies that was found in the wire the next morning after Tet. He was moved down at the perimeter wire trying to breach into Chulai the night of Tet. So it kind of made you sit back and think, hey, last week that guy was shaving my neck with a straight razor.
Mm-hmm.
And last night he got killed in the wire. So that's the kind of thing that became very commonplace, I guess. But his body was identified as one of the bodies
mm-hmm.
killed. Company. Of course, we were minus a company barber then.
Did you all enforce more strict regulations regarding having Vietnamese come into the base after that?
Yeah, they did. Of course, this was all handled above our level. We never.
You were just enforcing what came down.
Yeah. There was a process with the military police at division level to vet these people and let them onto the installation. And they all went through shakedown procedures, coming and going every day, see? So it required a little bit of guile to to do what he did, but he was there, every day
mm-hmm.
for for months. And you know, the he doesn't have to be stealing supplies and the information that he can take back.
That's right.
The measurements that he can give about where certain facilities within the company area are located and that kind of thing can greatly improve the accuracy of any incoming mortar fire and
pace things off.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Information back
and that kind of thing. Apparently, our experience with him was not terribly unusual. But that was one thing that, you know, I distinctly recall occurring.
Yes, sir.
And
well, what other events do you remember from Tet, and especially in the immediate, like for instance, just for the month of February, do you remember very much in terms of what was going on? And when you were fighting at that point, when you were going into on these assaults, was it against what you thought were Viet Cong units, that is South Vietnamese civilians that were guerrilla fighters, or were these the main force North Vietnamese units that were in there?
It was some of both.
Okay.
I think the experience of the unit down in Benoit was almost exclusively Viet Cong type units.
Because there's a fight like every hour, right?
Initially, when we went up to Chu Lai, we were mostly against Viet Cong forces, but well before Tet, this trend had changed, and we were going against North Vietnamese regulars.
Interesting.
More often, and that then was what it remained the rest of my time over there on that tour. Although things stayed pretty active. For a week or so after Tet,
okay.
And then, you know, action became almost non-existent.
Really?
Oh yeah. I say action. No, we were busy.
Sure.
Putting troops out, looking.
Right.
But we weren't getting any action.
Wow.
There was nothing there.
That's interesting.
I mean, we devastated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the North Vietnamese were totally.
Yeah. Well, they were expecting a general uprising, and they got.
And it didn't materialize.
Right.
It didn't materialize.
Right.
And they were totally devastated from Tet. You know, if we had pushed the advantage.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been the end of the whole thing right there, but you know that was not our goal, and you know, but all during the latter half of February and the first part of March, and I left about the 11th or 12th of March. I don't remember the exact date. You know, there were a lot of operations, a lot of busy work. There wasn't much happening.
Okay.
We weren't finding anything.
Okay. Well, when you left in March, did you come back? You came back to the U.S. and were an instructor at Fort Rucker, is that
yes.
Right? Well, how surprised were you by the atmosphere here in the United States when you came back? Or were you surprised at all?
Oh, I was very surprised. I really had no inkling over there of the level of dissatisfaction over the war until I came back. You know, I flew into Fort Lewis, SeaTac, I guess. and flew out of there, and there wasn't. There were, I saw a couple of demonstrators there, but really nothing compared to what I saw in 1970 when I went back, and 71 when I came back, and I did that down in out of Travis, north of San Francisco, and the anti-Vietnam sentiment was much higher down there. I remember at Fort Rucker, I lived on post at Fort Rucker headquarters on post, and I think this was in early 69, and I never went out there and never observed this, but I remember a couple of times an alert going out on over the post that we had demonstrators organizing at the gates at Fort Rucker, and we were supposed to stay away from the gates so there wouldn't be any confrontation or anything of that nature. And I thought, you know, this is just utterly ridiculous. You know, the whole idea that we're going to demonstrate against the military for what we're doing in Vietnam. I mean, if you want to demonstrate, you want to protest the war, get your ass up to Washington and talk to your congressman. He's the one that put the troops over there. But let's don't be bothering with the troops. But of course, that was not where the emphasis was.
So while you were at Rucker, were you training mostly warrant officers getting ready to go over to Vietnam?
Warrant officers and officers both. We had classes of both. More warrant officers than officers. But we did have both. I was assigned to what was called TAC-X, the Department of Tactics, at Fort Rucker. And the Department of Tactics consisted of TAC-1 and TAC-X. TAC-1 was where single ship tactics were taught, and TAC-X was where formation tactics were taught. TAC-X had the last 2 weeks of the student experience. We had them for 2 weeks, and then they graduated. In fact, we worked a 4-day week the first week, and a 3-day week the second week. And a typical day. We tried to be in position to start the flight day at the break of dawn, and we went until the day's mission was complete. During the summertime, that might be fairly early afternoon on some days. But on Thursday of the first week was night flight day. And so we flew until the night training was completed, which again depended upon the time of the year and how soon we could start in the evening. It would go until you know, you'd get home 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, Friday morning, during the summertime when it got dark late, and you'd get home around midnight during the wintertime when it got dark early. But it was formation flying and load flying and that kind of thing. We hauled internal loads and sling loads in formation. Did simulated combat assaults both at Fort Rucker and down at Eglin Air Force Base in Florida with the Ranger students during their swamp training down there to give the students the opportunity to actually fly the aircraft, because in a normal training situation, that's what you don't get. I mean, you learn to fly the helicopter, but you don't get all the other things in with it. But we did actual combat loads with the students on those days, and then on the second Wednesday, which was their last day of training, it terminated. They flew in. These students actually lived at a field site. We had a field site. We met them at the airfield on Monday morning of the first week, and flew out to the field site, and they stayed out there. We could come in at night, and we generally traveled back and forth by bus or by aircraft, because we are always exchanging some aircraft, bringing one in for maintenance and taking another one out. So you might have that, or you might ride on a bus. But the students stayed out in the field and lived out there for the duration. We would go out for the day's missions. We had an airfield out there that we flew out of near where they were camped and the whole bit. And then on that second Wednesday, we had a massive flyby. There were two companies of students going through simultaneously. And we'd have on the second Wednesday, we'd have a massive flyby of both companies in one massive formation, fly by the post parade field. And we had a set time that we were supposed to fly by the post headquarters and do that flyby. And you better be right within about 5 seconds of the appointed time over the flagpole, and then land at the airfield. And that was the end of their training. But during my last 6 months there, I was one of the flight commanders. I had one of the companies, and a good friend of mine had the other company, and we alternated classes, being responsible for leading the formation. And we went to great extremes with checkpoints all along the route to keep tabs of our time, and we'd slow down and speed up and do whatever was necessary to time ourselves to hit the flagpole. We'd always, just before we'd leave to go to the to start the flight in, one of the last things we did was call the general's secretary and get a time check with the clock there in the headquarters.
Okay.
And make sure that our watches were in sync with
sure.
with the time they had there. Because, you know, if your watch was off by a minute,
yeah.
you could hit right there at the time you were shooting for. But the general's looking at a different clock,
yep.
and he thinks you're a minute late. And he's very unhappy about that. So, and that all sounds utterly ridiculous. But it isn't. Mm-hmm. Because when you're doing a combat assault,
it's about precision.
That timing is everything.
Yep. It's about precision.
If you get to the LZ a minute early, you're going to be flying right into the suppression. And if you get there a minute late,
they got too much time.
Charlie's got time to get his head up and get ready for you.
That's right.
So, you know, and a lot of the things that when you talk about it in this kind of environment, it sounds ridiculous. What difference does it make whether you fly over the flagpole 15 seconds one way or the other? Don't make a bit of difference.
Well, I think what happened is,
but the skill that it teaches you,
sure,
is very important.
Yes, sir.
And that's what we were trying to do.
Yes, sir.
And it of course, you've been to Vietnam and you've coordinated those, mm-hmm, assaults, and that was my job,
sure,
as the operations officer.
Sure.
You already know,
that's right,
the importance of that. For that young student going through the training,
yeah,
this probably seemed like so much Mickey Mouse.
Yeah.
But he found out pretty shortly that it wasn't Mickey Mouse, because, mm-hmm, you know, his next stop was right where I had been. So.
Yes, sir. Now, was it only Americans you were training at Rucker, or did you have Vietnamese there as well?
We had a few. Each class would have not just Vietnamese, but allied students.
Yeah, other nationals.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. We had
okay.
We had all kinds of students. In fact, you know, most of the training courses that I attended in the military,
mm-hmm,
there were always some allied,
yeah,
students from somewhere in,
sure,
the classes.
Sure.
I had Iranian students,
yeah,
in my basic fixed wing,
mm-hmm,
training course,
yeah,
at Rucker in 63. The Shah was still in power, and,
yeah,
and we had four Iranians,
yeah,
in my class.
What made you decide to go back to Vietnam for your second tour? Because you had a volunteer for that, didn't you?
Where did you get your information?
You didn't go back to Vietnam?
Oh, yes. But I didn't volunteer.
You didn't volunteer?
Oh, no.
I thought you guys had a volunteer to go back for a second tour.
Oh, no.
They could send you back if they wanted.
No. You got selected, friend.
Oh, you got selected?
Yes.
Okay.
No,
right.
No. You didn't volunteer.
Very good.
I mean,
good.
You could. But not many people did.
Okay. All right. Well, then, how did you get selected? When did you go back for your second tour?
I went back in September of 1970.
Okay.
I went to Rucker. Arrived there in April of 68,
mm-hmm,
after taking 30 days leave out of Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And stayed at Rucker then until late August of 69,
mm-hmm,
terminating that assignment as the flight commander there in TAC-X,
mm-hmm,
and was selected for the Infantry Officers Advanced Course,
okay,
and went to Fort Benning,
mm-hmm,
to go to that course. That was about a 9-month course.
Okay.
And of course, coming out of Benning, I know where I'm going.
Sure.
I don't have to be told. So there's a lot of jockeying for whatever,
yeah,
I can get,
yeah,
en route. And I still want to fly motor engine fixed wing.
Oh, okay.
And I've gotten a what we refer to as a bootleg checkout,
mm-hmm,
in the T-42, which was the motor engine trainer. Mm-hmm. And I want to fly U-21s, which was the Queen Air I was trying to think of. I couldn't remember the designation,
okay,
but it was a U-21. That's what I want to fly in Vietnam on my second tour. And so I'm bargaining with Infantry Branch for a U-21 checkout, mm-hmm, and they tell me that, you know, the infantry has no requirement for U-21 pilots. Yeah. They don't need it. And they offer me a maintenance officer's course at Fort Eustis. Well, you know, maintenance doesn't appeal to me. I don't want that. We finally compromise. They're going to send me to the infantry, not the infantry, to the instrument examiner's course,
okay,
at Fort Rucker,
okay,
en route back to Vietnam. I'm going to be an instrument examiner. Well, Army regulations say that in order to be an instrument examiner, in order to go to the course, you've got to have a current instrument ticket.
Okay.
Mine's expired.
Okay.
So I told the guy this. Oh, don't worry about it. They'll renew it for you down there. I said, well, the reg doesn't say that. It says it's got to be current when you start. Don't worry about it. They'll take care of it for you. All right. So I go to Fort Rucker after I finish the advanced course. TDY down there, you know, got my mm-hmm wife with me and everything. Mm-hmm. And first thing they do is, your ticket's expired. Yeah, Branch told me not to worry about it. Y'all would take care of it. Uh-uh, you can't get in the course. You got a U-21 class starting anytime? Yeah, I got a class starting next Monday. Got any openings in it? Well, we got one, but you got to get your branch to get you the quota. So I call that branch assignments officer back. I says, they won't let me in the class. You got me down here wasting the government's money for nothing. I got a solution for you, though. If you'll go over and talk to so-and-so, they've got a quota for one U-21 slot. You can get it for me. I can fly U-21s. Well, of course, he had some choice things to say to me about going behind his back and setting these things up. But he did it. And I got the U-21 checkout, which was what I wanted. And my stick mate in the U-21 class had a good friend who was the company executive officer in the CAC company at Longthorn,
mm-hmm,
which was the Command Airplane Company, that's what CAC stood for,
mm-hmm,
which was the VIP fixed wing unit in Vietnam. That's all they did was ash and trash hauling generals around the country in U-21s.
And where was that based again?
Longthorn. That's down by Long Bend, not far from Long Bend.
Okay.
And so...
so that's where you need to be assigned.
That's where I wanted to go. And he contacted his buddy over there in the company, and they had it all set up. The skids were greased for us to go and fly U-21s. I'm going to enjoy this tour. I mean, they had oxygen. You fly that thing at 20,000 feet. See, it's cool up there. You're not landing. Anytime you're landing, you're going into an improved airfield.
Right. Like I said, VIPs.
That's white shirt flying.
Yeah.
Helicopters, that's blue collar.
Right.
See, that's dirty work. So I'm really excited. And I get to Long Bend, and sure enough, the guy had the skids greased. The CAC company was assigned to the 164th group at Long Bend, the group headquarters was a long bin. And the 164th, they were not a typical group in Vietnam. They had the CAC company. They had the 120th Assault Helicopter Company, which was the VIP helicopter company. And they had a Bird Dog Radio Relay Company, the 173rd, I think it was. And they had all of the airfield detachments which operated the control towers and everything on all the Army airfields. They had just a mishmash of stuff there. And I made it down as far as 164th Group. And the 120th had a series of safety incidents involving, for lack of a better term, lack of command discretion within the company. And the CG had gone on a rampage, and the commander had been relieved, and they had decreed a whole list of things that would apply to this 120th AHC and the assignment of personnel to it. Chief among them being that the commander of the 120th would be a lieutenant colonel. And the XO and all the key officers in the company would be majors. We would all be second tour aviators, no first tour personnel in the command structure of the unit. We had to have standard instrument tickets. We had to have a certain number of you know, certain positions within the company had to have these just a whole list of things. And the change of command for the lieutenant colonel to take over had occurred the day before.
Okay.
And they were looking for an XO. And I'm now a major, second tour aviator.
There you go.
And I float into the group that commands this company.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my buddy went and flew U-21s. I went to the 120th.
Okay. And where were they stationed again?
The 120th was actually stationed at Long Bend.
It was in Long Bend.
Yeah, we were at Long Bend.
And you were the XO.
And I'm the XO. The commander was one of the greatest commanders I ever worked for. I loved the guy. It was a really fun 6 months. He of course understood that was not what I wanted when I went there. But he promised me if I would come and be his XO for 6 months, he would get me a command one way or another for the second half of my tour.
So, and this is September 1970.
This is September of 1970.
Of course, now we're in the height of what Nixon was referring to as Vietnamization.
Oh, absolutely.
So what was the mission of the 120th at that point? Who were you supporting, and what were you guys trying to accomplish there in the Long Bend area?
Well, the mission of the 120th was support of USRV and MACV headquarters. We were, as I say, the VIP company. We flew all the headquarters staff around. So
to include General Abrams?
To include General Abrams. We had General Abrams aircraft. Actually, we had a detachment of the 120th with General Abrams aircraft, the USRV and MACV deputies, aircraft stationed at Hotel 3 in Saigon. That detachment was down there, three aircraft with the crews and all the support necessary for that aircraft.
Okay.
They were detached from the company, but they belonged to us. And I used to go down and coordinate with them quite often. We also had, now those three aircraft were assigned. Nobody got those but those generals.
Yes, sir.
And those crews didn't fly anybody but those generals.
Right.
Everybody else was on an as-needed basis,
mm-hmm.
with the exception of we had one, and I can't remember now the guy's name, but one two-star that just gave us a fit.
Yeah.
Everything, you know, he thought he was a prima donna, and every mission that we had, he was raising hell about this or that. We'd have my primary job was to answer all the complaints and the inquiries and all that stuff. I was, the commander told me when I went in, he had been an S1,
mm-hmm.
battalion S1,
mm-hmm.
in the cav,
mm-hmm.
on his first tour over there.
Okay.
And as a battalion S1, he had primarily flown a desk. He'd gotten out and flown very little. And he saw my flight records when I checked in there, and he said, "You got your time the last time. I'm getting mine this time. You run the company, and I'm going flying." So he spent most of his days out flying, and I spent my days handling the paperwork in the order room, which is not unusual for an XO. Usually the XO is the admin type.
Right, right.
And the commander is out with the company, and that's what we did. But it was a rare day in the 6 months that I was there. It was a rare day that I flew. And I did my instrument ticket was expired, as I said before. And he did get me out enough to get that renewed. And that kind of thing. But I flew just enough really to make the minimum. At that time, you know, the Army was still operating on the minimum number of hours system. You had to fly every month and get so much a year and all this. So I was flying enough to do that, but that was about it.
Okay.
And I operated the admin side of the company. And sure enough, after 6 months, he got me a company.
Okay. Which company was that?
I commanded the 335th, the Cowboys, down at Dong Tam, which was the old 9th Division base camp down in the Delta.
Uh-huh.
Of course, the 9th Division was long gone.
So this is into 71.
This is March of 71. I took that command. March of 71.
How close to the Cambodian border were you?
Oh, we were well away from the Cambodian border.
Okay.
We were south of Saigon, but not over on the border.
Okay.
That's right in the heart of the Mekong
Delta. Yeah, okay.
The biggest thing we had to worry about down there was the water. The entire base camp there,
mm-hmm.
was built out of dredgings from the Mekong River.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the first things I faced when I went down there, we were just entering the rainy season, and I get up one morning and it's raining. Company area is just a quagmire of mud. And I go over to the mess hall, and the mess hall is closed. And the mess hall is closed because the mess hall has a foot of water.
Oh, goodness.
In it. And by now, you know, it's 71, we've got stateside type cooking equipment, not fuel stoves. And with all the electrical power and everything in there, it's not safe to use the facility.
Sure.
We've cut the power to it. And I've got an aviation company and all of its detachments that's going to be eating cold sea rations for breakfast. And this is in 1971, and this is not the way to do things. So I go on a campaign to try to get better drainage in the area. And I harangued with post engineers for several days about what was needed to drain that area. And they just, you know, they don't know what to do. I mean, my mess hall was built too low, and you know, it's not just the mess hall area, but the whole drainage system of the entire installation is operating above capacity, and it won't take the water away. I can't figure out what the hell I'm gonna do. I can't be having interruptions like this every time it rains, because it's gonna rain every day, continuously. Situation's only going to get worse. Okay, get me some cement. What are you going to do? Well, this whole country operates on dikes.
Say somebody comes to us as a provider, a full-time.
I'm going to build a dike around the mess hall. So we framed up a mold there about 18 inches high. You know, the mess hall was sitting on a concrete slab. It was built on a slab, and it was just one of these screen wire wall buildings, but on a slab, with tin roof over it and all that. So boards up about waist high and then screen wire on up. And we went right around the slab outside the building, right on the outside of the wall, with about an 18 inch high, 4 or 5 inch wide cement dike. And we didn't keep it dry inside, but we kept the water from accumulating in there.
Sure.
You know, it got in at such a speed that you could keep it mopped out.
Okay.
And continue to operate.
Well, that's good. Yeah, see, that's part of. Now, what was the overall mission of the 335th in that area? Who were you guys supporting? What were you guys doing?
We were supporting, and I've forgotten now the number of the division, but South Vietnamese
Arvin division. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, strictly Arvin. We had no U.S. troops down there other than their advisors. The nature of our combat assaults had changed somewhat. We never in the entire, and I only commanded the company about 4 months because I had a son born the day I left Long Bend to go to to go to Don Penn to take the company. The day before I actually took the company, a son was born that had some medical problems that wound up in late July. He was going to have surgery to repair some things, and I came back for the surgery, and because I would have less than 30 days to do when I got back in the country, they didn't send me back. So I only got about 4 months command time. But
well, for those 4 months, how would you evaluate the performance of the Arvin forces that were working in that area that you supported? Do you think they were ready to take on that responsibility, or did they need more time to train?
They needed more time. Yeah. They were like any other group. Yeah. Some of them were very dedicated, very competent.
Yeah.
Others were not. But by and large, I would have to say that the command structure was
it doesn't show the flash. To stand right straight in front of it.
Was not dedicated, and in fact, a good number of them were not loyal. I think most of the guys would tell you that even when we were over there, for the most part, in a combat assault, you would not want to turn your back on a Vietnamese with a loaded weapon.
You need to go into that room.
I think all of our crew members would tell you that they were on combat assaults involving the Vietnamese. They watched them very closely. There was a lot of caution about how we dealt with them. In most cases, that was not necessary. But in a few cases, it was, and you couldn't tell the difference in it. So, yeah.
Well, when you came back after your second tour back to the U.S., could you tell a difference in the atmosphere in the country?
Oh, very, very definitely. Leaving, going over, and coming back. Both times was out of Travis. I didn't come back into SeaTac the second time. And, I flew into San Francisco and out of San Francisco for the stateside portion of the trip. And, the demonstrators at the gate at Travis and at the San Francisco airport were very evident. Signs, insults, the whole bit. A lot of our briefings, in returning were aimed at preparing us for that, telling us what to expect and totally ignore it, do your thing, don't get involved, we don't want any confrontations between the military and the demonstrators. But people spitting at you and things like that were very common. Saw that all the time. And
this is part of the ballroom we don't have. Okay, actually.
Like I say,
the boardroom do?
Okay. So we can't lock that?
My it can be locked feelings on Iraq were simply to avoid a repeat.
Well, what did you think when President Nixon announced the success of Vietnamization after the Christmas bombing campaign in December 72, and then the peace accords, of course, of early 73, and the fact that now we're going to completely withdraw and leave South Vietnamese to its own devices? Of course, with aid, we're going to provide them with whatever support we need, they need in terms of material and economic aid, but we're going to completely withdraw our military forces.
Well, I have always felt that we abandoned our allies. I have very, very strong feelings about that. I'm a strong believer that you should think very carefully before you get involved in something of that nature, and be sure that it's something you're willing to see through to the end. We made commitments to those people, and we did not honor those commitments. And I'm sure we got a lot of people hurt because of that. Mm-hmm. And we got a lot of those people and our people killed. And the bottom line is, what did we accomplish? And in my mind, we accomplished nothing. And that hurts.
Take
above my pay grade.
Well, what did you think when you heard that Saigon fell in April 75?
Well, certainly not surprised, disappointed and hurt, but not surprised. Of course, Saigon falling did not occur overnight. There was a build up to it, and it was very predictable. But it took several years to accomplish because of the damage that we inflicted during Tet of 68.
Yes.
Tet of 68 was the catalyst that ended our involvement in the war. But it was also a major mistake on the part of the North Vietnamese. Major mistake. But I guess it all depends on outlook and what you're willing to sacrifice. But the bottom line is, they were willing to sacrifice more than we were willing to sacrifice.
So very perceptive points.
Mm-hmm. Well. I've had a lot of time to think about it, so it's not hard to come up with those kind of perceptions.
Would there be anything in particular you'd want future generations to remember about the Vietnam War?
Well, yeah, I think so. And that is to learn the appropriate lessons from the Vietnam War. Any war is a dirty, nasty, rotten business.
Yeah, right around to the right here.
And if you don't have the fortitude to see it through, then don't start it. And that goes without saying, regardless of how you feel about the Vietnamese War, whether we should have been in there or whether we should have not been in there, is totally immaterial. If we were not going to execute it properly, then we shouldn't have got into it. All we did was we set the military back many, many years, and did a lot of damage to a lot of people. We lost a lot of good people, and I think so far as most of us are concerned, we wasted them for no accomplishment at all. And that really is the part of the Vietnam War that hurts.
Yes, sir.
You know, I'm proud of my record there. I think I did my job, and I think the guys that were there, including the ones that died, did their job, and they don't deserve what happened to them.
So,
and I blame Johnson and Mr. McNamara and their regime for that. I blame some of the generals who, you know, I said earlier, I think that MacArthur had gotten out of line and was a prima donna. But if he truly felt, truly believed what he was espousing, then I admire him for taking the stand that he did.
Sure.
I agree that the president has to be the final word, and so I admire Truman for firing him. But at least MacArthur had the fortitude to stand up and take his firing. There's no question but what some of the army hierarchy, some of the military hierarchy, were yes men during the Vietnam War, and they gave Johnson they gave him what they thought he wanted to hear. I don't think that can be disputed. I don't know of a single one that lost his job for standing up for what he thought was right. Did they all truly believe that we should be in Vietnam? I don't know. If they didn't, somebody should have gotten fired, because somebody should have stood up and said no. Somebody should have told the man that we can't wage a war the way you're requiring us to wage it. Somebody should have made that point. And apparently no one did, because no one got fired over it. But I think anyone who has ever been involved in a war knows that you can't wage one that way. You can't place those kinds of restrictions on the man on the ground and expect him to succeed. And you can't give an enemy safe sanctuary and expect to defeat him. And that's what we did.
Is there anything else you'd like to add to your interview?
I don't know of anything. I'd be glad to, you know, I'm enjoying it. I'll talk to you as long as you want to talk, but you know, I've had a very happy and successful life since then, and hopefully I'm going to go on for a good number more years.
Oh, I did want to ask you about the VA. How well do you think the VA has been taking care of you and other Vietnam veterans?
I think probably, as is the case with any medical care, as good or as bad as the primary physician you get assigned. I did not use the VA for many years. After I retired about 6 or 7 years ago, as long as I worked with Northern, I had excellent medical insurance with them, and I didn't do anything with the military.
Sure.
I was completely out of it. And then about 6 or 7 years ago, I was diagnosed as diabetic, mm-hmm. on top of the heart condition and all that. And my insurance was not quite as good in retirement as it had been with Northern. Mm-hmm. Not only was my insurance not quite as good, but I was forced into, I was in an HMO while I was working, and there was no paperwork involved. Everything was, you know, and that was easy enough to handle. Out of the into retirement, I could not take the HMO with me. I had to go to an 80-20 plan that they offered, and that became a nightmare so far as the paperwork and all the hassle, and this wasn't filed correctly, and that wasn't, you know, and it just drove me up a tree. And plus, my insurance with Northern was not free. I had to pay for it. And what was a nominal fee when I retired over the years kept increasing. The last year I carried it, I was paying over $400 a month for the insurance for my wife and I. And so I decided to cancel that and go with strictly military coverage, and I bought a supplement to supplement that. But when I was diagnosed diabetic, I had heard that the VA had an excellent diabetes management program, and because of Agent Orange, there were service-connected possibilities there and all that. So I went to the VA. And I finally got into the system and was assigned a primary care provider and was very impressed with the service I received.
Okay.
That went along for about 3 years, and my primary provider left, took a full-time job over at Duke there in Durham, and I got assigned a new one. And since then, I haven't felt that the care was quite as good.
Okay.
Now, the diabetes management program is still quite good. They offered a comprehensive diabetes education program that my wife and I both attended. And they monitor me quite closely for diabetes. I go about every 3 months in to see what's termed a foot nurse, who examines my feet and makes sure that, you know, circulation is still good in the feet and all that.
Right.
And out of that, I get a pedicure about every 3 months, which, if you've ever had one, is a very pleasant experience. And you know, so I enjoy that. And I'm getting good eye care with the VA now. These are VA glasses.
Okay.
And they cost me the price of having them tinted.
Okay.
They cost me $70. But the examination and the basic glasses are free, and if I wanted non-tinted glasses, the glasses would be free.
Yeah.
And it's a much more attractive frame than what the Army will give me. And the Army won't give me an eye examination. I work up at Fort Lee one day a week now as a Red Cross volunteer in the pharmacy. I pass out refill prescriptions. And, I find that, a lot of fun, get back with the military and plus stay in touch with things. And I pick up medication from the Army while I'm up there, the drugs that they carry that we're on, I can get them there. And they're available at no cost, but I can't see a doctor up there or anything like that. I could get a pair of glasses up there if I took a doctor's prescription up there, but they're the old horn rim oddball looking glasses.
The military issue glasses.
Military issue, yeah. And all of the female troops up there refer to them as the birth control glasses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because you're guaranteed not to reproduce as long as you're wearing
them. Not to get any dates. You wear those, you don't get any dates.
Yeah. But not that that's significant, but I don't like the looks of the damn things. And these are more, to my way of thinking, mainstream glasses. And they're just as good. I've been through, like I say, the diabetes management program. I've been through traumatic stress syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
Or post-traumatic stress syndrome, I guess it is. I was having trouble with my thought processes there. I've been through their evaluation for that. Mm-hmm. They've concluded that, I have moderate to severe symptoms, but for the most part, I don't think that I really have a problem. My wife says I have a much shorter fuse than I used to have.
Mm-hmm. But you seem to have incorporated your experiences in Vietnam and made it something productive in your life, something positive, for the most part.
Well, I'd like to think so.
Yes, sir.
Everything that we do in life, every experience that we have, affects what we are and who we are, and that certainly has had an effect on me, but I can't say that it was all negative. I certainly feel like all of my association with these guys, including over there, was positive. Even some of them that I may not always agree with.
Sure.
they're still brothers, and we're a team.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I sometimes get very sentimental.
Yes, sir. And that's understandable. It's understandable.
But?
All right.
I have thoroughly enjoyed this.
Well, thank you, sir.
I hope I haven't bored you too much.
Not at all.
And
not at
that
all.
You'll find something
this
useful in all
area.
That.
Why don't I go ahead and I guess I'll put an official ending on it. This will conclude the interview, and I should have given the date at the beginning, on the 20th of April, 2006, with Mr. Harold Bowen. Thank you very much, sir. Appreciate it.
Thank you.